Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames, the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. And not only are we doing a Missing Frames thing right now, we are going to blow people's minds. The internet isn't ready for this. We are doing, I think this is the first official Missing Frames crossover with Rest in Pictures podcast. Brad Gullickson and Aaron Prescott are on the show together. It's just craziness. I can't even handle it. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I was going to let Aaron speak first.
Oh, were you? I should let you speak first.
Let's do that again. Let's do that again. I'm so happy to have you guys on the show.
Thank you.
This is terrible. This is the worst. This is the worst episode of either of our podcasts.
I will doubt that highly. You should hear the way we ramble about nonsense on our podcast.
But it's fantastic. It's fantastic rambling.
Sure. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Sure. All right. We'll take it. Well, you know, if we're going to be talking about worst things ever, we should be talking about someone who made arguably the worst movie ever, or that's the reputation, and not necessarily that person, but a movie about that person. We are going to be watching Ed Wood, which is a film I have been dying to see. I've never seen it. I'm the only one here, I believe, who has not seen this movie.
This is a great film.
Yes.
It's Tim Burton's best film, without a doubt.
Wow. Yes. Yeah.
I don't know how much of a accurate representation of it is of the actual Ed Wood, because I'm here to confess that I've never seen an Ed Wood film.
Oh, really?
No. I've never seen Plan 9 from Outer Space. I have never seen Glenn or Glenda. But I can tell you that this is a great movie.
Yeah. Those are the only two I've seen. And I got to see Glenn or Glenda on the big screen along with the Mads themselves. Because that's the way I'm associated with Ed Wood, is with Mystery Science Theater 3000. And we had the Mads come out to the Alamo, and they did a riffing of Glenn or Glenda, and that was fantastic.
I've only seen Plan 9 from Outer Space, and I didn't have the benefit of Mystery Science Theater 3000 to guide me through it, unfortunately. But I was impressed by how awful. Is that the one where someone's walking through a graveyard and the gravestones are falling over because they're cardboard? That is it. Okay,
yes.
Then I am thinking of the right movie. Here's the thing, and this is going to be a whole. I'm opening up a can of worms, and I'm gonna have to. I have to preface this by asking you to be kind to me when I say this. I'm not a big Tim Burton fan.
Okay, that's okay. Totally understandable,
yeah.
Sean.
Yeah,
that's understandable because at least two films after Ed Wood, from the second half of Sleepy Hollow forward, his career is garbage.
Is that the definitive point? Scientifically, that's been proven.
Half.
Yeah. All right.
The second half on.
I would just give it straight to Mars Attacks. I would say from the beginning of his filmography up until Mars Attacks, which is the film afterwards. That's where I cut it.
It's just that Sleepy Hollow is such a delicious love letter to Hammer films. I feel like they get a lot right with the actors and the set pieces and the cinematography. It's that whole narrative where they fumble. So I like to give a partial credit to Sleepy Hollow.
Okay.
So here's what I have seen. I've seen Beetlejuice, which I really loved. I thought that was great.
Accurate opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Batman and Batman Returns, I've never been a big fan of. You guys are going to hate me. Batman Returns might be my least favorite Batman movie.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting, because I can see you not liking the 89 Batman. I enjoy it for nostalgia and as a Tim Burton film.
Agreed.
But I just rewatched Batman Returns in the build-up to the holidays, and I still think that's a pretty damn good movie. Weird, but pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
I might have to... Here's the thing. When I watch those movies, I watch them in the context of being a Batman fan.
Yeah, you
more
shouldn't
than a Tim
do
Burton
that.
Fan.
Yeah.
Right. And I feel like I'm getting to a point now where I'm able to appreciate, like, oh, a unique artist has come in and given his, like, kooky take on this comic book character. I think a lot of my hatred and anger for those movies is like, what? He doesn't understand Batman. This
that's
is stupid.
True.
So I think a lot, to be fair, I think a lot of it, I think if I tried to approach it with a less critical eye in that regard and more of a, like, let me just watch it from a film perspective, it would be interesting, especially in the context of his career. Because Batman was what, his third movie?
He
did Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah, it's his third feature. Yeah,
I mean, that's crazy. For some reason I didn't think of that. For some reason, but I thought Edward Scissorhands came before that.
Let's put an asterisk on the Batman films and let's just push them aside. What else have you seen?
Other than that, this is great. Planet of the Apes.
Okay, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay, see, this is what we're talking about. This is why you hate him. Okay.
Right. So Big Fish, which I like.
It's fine, man.
Yeah, fine.
I like how your voice goes up a register. It's fine. Big Fish, and that's also one I haven't seen in a while, and I remember really liking it. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
No.
Nope.
Okay.
No.
We don't like that one, and it's been a long time since I've seen that. And Sweeney Todd, which I wasn't into, and I know some people really like that. Where do you guys fall on Sweeney Todd?
I'm gonna do the Brad.
Okay.
It's fine. It's okay.
It's fine.
Yeah, I think going into that, I think part of the problem was not being a Tim Burton fan, and that felt so much for Tim Burton fans that I was like, I think this was not made for me.
So have you not seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
I've not.
Okay, we got to rearrange this entire podcast.
Yeah, that's true.
And I haven't seen Edward Scissorhands either. I think I may have said that, but
I like Edward Scissorhands. I think that's a solid flick. I also really enjoy Beetlejuice. Pee-wee's Big Adventure is my second favorite Tim Burton movie, right behind Ed Wood.
I think we're I think we're holding hands together, Brad. I'm right there with you.
Oh,
yeah.
This is also the most romantic. This is not only the worst episode. This is the most romantic episode I think we've done yet. And I'm really happy about that. But yeah, maybe it's one of those things where I think Tim Burton, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys have seen more than I have, but Tim Burton got really high on Tim Burton, it feels like, somewhere in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, and it became less enjoyable to watch him. And then I had this really awful association where I started to make a joke about it, and now I can't get it out of my head, but it's watching a Tim Burton movie is like walking into a Hot Topic. And this was back at the turn of the century when Hot Topic was very much like right now. I think they're trying to rebrand themselves a little bit, but back then when I was in high school, it was very much the goth hangout emo place where Tim Burton fans went to die or thrive, or I don't know. But I think a lot of my annoyance is because of that. But I think like Brad's saying and like Aaron's saying, the early Tim Burton films seem to be where it's at. Or maybe the comedies are the ones I would appreciate more.
I don't know. I think it's a case of an artist has a tremendous burst of creativity. You know, he jumps out with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns, Ed Wood, and continues into Mars Attacks. But I really feel like Ed Wood is a turning point. I think Mars Attacks is great, Aaron. I don't disagree with you. I just rewatched it. It's fantastic. But that does feel like where he starts reaching and achieving mainstream popularity and attacking mainstream type of entertainment. And I don't think that always gels with his sensibility. And also it just might be a case of he's spent by this point, even though he keeps getting money
this
to
was
make
also,
movies.
Yeah. This was also within like the throes of him wrestling with Superman Lives and that not getting off the ground. And
that's
so,
right.
You know, I think there's this, he always feels like he has like this sense of like nostalgia, but it's a very specialized sense of nostalgia that he, I don't know. I think that he's kind of reimagined into his own head. And so no matter what the Batman that's going into his head, it's going to be a different Batman coming out, and the same with Superman. Mm-hmm. And I think even with Ed Wood, I think we're going to, you know, it'll be interesting to see, because I haven't watched this in, man, probably at least 15 years. And, you know, it's something that I feel like, you know, he's going to kind of ingest the persona of Ed Wood in a differently and kind of spit it out in his own way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a film about passion, mm-hmm. and the idea of even if you don't have the talent, but you have the will to put yourself out there, that is admirable and something to strive towards, and something also incredibly relatable. And I like to think Ed Wood as a very inspirational figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe he was or he wasn't. I honestly have no idea.
Well, I was reading about the movie, just trying to not spoil myself, but get some context for this conversation. And I did read that part of what attracted Burton to this movie was reading Ed Wood's like firsthand accounts of his productions and treating them as if they were masterpieces. There was no disconnect. He could not separate himself enough to say like, oh, well, you know what? Yeah, you're right. I'll do better next time. He was convinced that he was making like gold.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He was very much the Mark Borchardt of the 50s and 60s to steal from American movie, where he has this like uncanny sense of wanting to make the best movie ever, but just not having the talent like at all.
I feel like Disaster Artist probably took some pages from this movie as well. Not the book, but the movie of the Disaster Artist.
I think Disaster Artist, the film, certainly wants to be Ed Wood in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And my issues with the Franco film is probably because of that lens he sees Tommy Wiseau through.
Right, because Tommy Wiseau, just judging from Sestero's book, which is fantastic, is kind of a jerk. He doesn't come across as like, oh yeah, he's sweet and he wants to do his best. He just seems like maniacal.
Well, Sestero's book is great. And if they had filmed Sestero's book as written, I think it would be a much more rich and complicated narrative. What Franco does is he falls in love with the Wiseau persona as seen through the success of The Room. And that's a very different story than what Sestero was shoveling.
Right. So with Ed Wood, do you, Aaron, remember what prompted you to watch this movie? Was it just on your own or did you feel like you had to see it?
Yeah, no, I think it was just I had already gone through the rest of the early Tim Burton movies. I have pretty much grown up on especially, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Edward Scissorhands. I remember watching those two a lot. And I think it was around the time where maybe I'd seen Mars Attacks and it was just kind of like, oh, here's Ed Wood. And maybe it was kind of, you know, off-putting for me at that time to like, you know, it was kind of me kind of getting into, you know, deeper films. And for Burton to put out a black and white film in the mid-90s, that's not like a, you know, it's not Schindler's List. It's something completely different. It's much more a comedy. That's a daring move and something, you know, that probably, you know, didn't interact with fans. I don't believe it made that much money in the theater. So
it didn't. It did not. It was a pretty big flop from what I understood. Yeah. So its budget was $18 million and it made around $6 million.
Yeah, that's not good.
No, not at all. But I thought for some reason people love this movie so much. Maybe it's just in retrospect they've looked back on it. But I hear when people talk about this movie, they talk about it with such fondness that I thought it was at least a modest hit. But that's so interesting. But Brad, go ahead.
I was just gonna say maybe it's much more of a niche thing for us as cinephiles because I'm very much, you know, into any movie that's movies about movies. I'll watch anything. You know, and so I think I probably at that point had already seen Mystery Science Theater or had seen the Plan 9 from Outer Space, and I was kind of like, oh, that's this guy, and so I kind of, you know, connected the dots together. So it was already an understanding of what he has produced. Why is this such an like an iconic, you know, figure in Hollywood that he's known as the best worst director of all time?
Brad, do you remember first time you saw Ed Wood?
It was a similar situation where I went back to watch it. In 1994, I was 15. I was not digging black and white cinematography. I was probably of the opinion that, oh, that's old. Why would you bother making a movie with black and white cinematography? That's stupid. But as I got it, as I became obsessive with the behind-the-scenes stuff, not necessarily just movies in general, but I became obsessed with how movies were made and where influences come from and things like that. I went back and watched Tim Burton's Ed Wood sometime in college, and I was floored when I watched it on VHS.
Mm.
That was my first
time. The good old days.
Yeah, and I immediately fell in love with Johnny Depp's performance and just how obvious of a fan Tim Burton must have been of this filmmaker when making this movie.
That's the other thing I'm excited to see, because I like Tim Burton, Johnny Depp has, it feels like, had a very similar trajectory where it's like Johnny Depp has become so obsessed with being Johnny Depp that you forget how good he was when he was just doing the part.
And there's like a lot of ugliness just around his personal
life. Right, exactly. He's kind of tainted now. So it'll be nice to go back and see. I know he was very highly praised. I feel like at the time he was highly praised in this performance. I don't know if there was Oscar talk or anything, but I feel
Martin
like this movie
Landau
is real.
Martin was the big takeaway from Ed Wood at the time. I remember
was this,
when he was
Rick
nominated.
Baker?
I don't think so. I will have to look real quick.
It is. Yeah, he did.
It is?
Okay. Yep. Rick Baker and Martin Landau. That's what, I didn't realize he was in it.
Oh yeah, he's fantastic. Pull
and
the
Bill
strings.
Murray, I did not. Patricia Arquette. My goodness.
It's a great cast.
It's quite a cast, yeah. And I want to say, if I remember right, Vincent D'Onofrio is playing
Orson Welles.
Yeah, he's playing Orson Welles, but I believe they redubbed his voice, and it's actually the voice of the guy that voiced Pinky or Brain from Pinky
Maurice
and the Brain.
LaMarche.
Maurice LaMarche.
Oh, that's so funny.
And I believe he's uncredited, so I'm not sure if it was just like a last minute switcheroo, and they didn't want to go with D'Onofrio's voice or whatever it was.
Which is funny because I feel like D'Onofrio, especially after watching his Kingpin performance, could have pulled off an Orson Welles. Maybe he wasn't ready. Maybe he just wasn't ready at the time of Ed Wood. Well, I'm genuinely excited to watch this. Like I said, I've been, even though I've been outspoken about my general disinterest in Tim Burton, I've always been quick to admit I haven't seen a lot of what people consider his best movies. Ed Wood, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Edward Scissorhands is another one people keep telling me to see. But I'm excited to see it, and I'm excited to discuss it with you two gentlemen. So let's get to it.
Yes, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Gentlemen, I think I can officially say this is my favorite Tim Burton movie. With pleasure, I can say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
We did it.
We did it.
We did it. Case closed.
That's it. That's the end of the episode. But yeah. I know technically it's not saying a lot since I went on in the first part about, I'm not a big Tim Burton fan and everything. But I was very impressed with this movie, and mostly impressed by how subtle it is. I mean, it's zany and it's a little exaggerated, but it's very restrained for Burton for the most part. At least the most restrained movie of his that I've seen.
It definitely is. I think it's the most un-Burton flick, which I think says a lot more to just as we see Ed Wood's passion as a filmmaker. I think this is his passion for something that made him want to be a filmmaker, and I think that kind of shows on screen. As opposed to like, I feel like with most of his films, he probably, because he started off as an animator, I imagine he starts most of his movies off with conceptual drawings and stuff like that. And I feel like this, he already had the story of, I want to tell the story of Ed Wood in his head before the style, you know, behind it.
I don't know, not to push back on both of you right from the jump, but I do see a lot of Tim Burton in the film. And, you know, you look at how this movie opens with the credits and how he's trying to replicate the style of Ed Wood's crappy little movies and pushing in on Jeffrey Jones as Criswell announcing this strange and odd story of Edward D. Wood Jr. It's in keeping with the spirit of Ed Wood's movies, but it also, I mean, it does feel like a Tim Burton joint,
but restrained, right? I'm just saying, but it does feel restrained. It doesn't feel like the overly, like, you know, adrenaline rush that he usually kind of infuses into his kind of like morbid adrenaline rush, whatever that might be.
Yeah, but there's nothing restrained about Johnny Depp as Ed Wood.
No.
I mean, he's incredibly zany in the film. And one of the things I did before watching Ed Wood is I made sure to finally see Plan 9 from Outer Space, as well as Glenn or Glenda. And in particular, in watching Glenn or Glenda, that Ed Wood is not the Ed Wood that Johnny Depp is in this film.
That's what I've heard, is that it's really, like, Johnny Depp kind of, I think, takes the idea of Ed Wood and just amplifies it.
And I think that's what Tim Burton's doing. It's extremely heightened.
That's what I was going to say. I think, because I feel kind of in the middle of this debate, which is that it feels like the most restrained Tim Burton movie that I've seen. I think it is. But at the same time, it's unmistakably Tim Burton. I don't think anyone else could have made this movie. And not only that,
agreed,
but the fact that he is so clearly in love with the subject. And I see so many different versions of this movie. Even, I think we talked a little bit about it, but The Disaster Artist, which very desperately wanted to be this movie. Disaster Artist is a little condescending of Tommy Wiseau as well. You kind of can't help it. But Tim Burton is fully embracing the love of this group of people.
Yeah, it's a celebration. There's that line in the film where Sarah Jessica Parker's Dolores, like, storms in on the set and, you know, says, like, look at all these weirdos or whatever. And, you know, Burton is proud to be one of Ed Wood's weirdos. And that's clear watching this movie. And if we're talking restrained Tim Burton, just one more time to keep pushing back against what you guys are saying, I would argue that
you don't even believe this. You just want to argue with us.
I do. But the least Tim Burton movies in my mind are films that Sean has not seen. But Big Eyes feels very un-Tim Burton to me. And I think even Big Fish is a little more restrained than
Ed Wood. So movies
Ed
with
Wood.
big in the title and with two words.
And okay. That's it. I'm gonna back off a little bit.
Well, I like you. I did, because you kind of mentioned it in the chat. You were like, I'm going to watch Plan 9. I'm going in. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So this kind of ended up being a double feature, Missing Frames, for me. Even though I'd seen bits of Plan 9 before, I don't think I'd ever sat through the whole thing. And my God, Brad, I don't know if you want to regale the audience with your description of what your experience was watching it, but I had a similar experience.
15 minutes into the movie, I was really enjoying it. 20 minutes into the movie, I was like, well, okay, this is not good. And then by the end, I just like, how much more of this film is there? And it's only like an hour and 20 minutes, but it really starts to feel it, especially when they start focusing the story on the aliens.
Oh, my God. I couldn't figure out for halfway through. I was like, I thought this is an alien movie. Why is there a vampire? And why are there zombies in this movie? I could not figure out.
I love all that madness.
Well, the problem is it's a lot of just like beyond the insanity of it. It's a lot of just people like talking at length
narration
about things. And exactly, in the narration. And it was a painful experience. But I am glad I watched it before.
Same.
I watched Ed Wood. It kind of gave me a context. But one thing that was surprising about Ed Wood is I thought it specifically focused on Plan 9. I did not realize that was just the end, like basically the final 20 minutes is them doing Plan 9. I thought the whole movie was that.
Plan 9 is like the climactic hurrah of this film. And I had also forgotten how much Glenn or Glenda took up of the plot. In fact, I think, like, if we're talking one particular Ed Wood movie, that really seems to be the one that takes up the most amount of screen time within the Burton film. And revisiting that movie, or actually in watching that film for the first time, I was surprised at how good Glenn or Glenda is. Again, not a great movie, an awkward movie, a poorly made film, way mm-hmm. too much narration, way too much stock footage. But that heart that Ed Wood had for that character is very empathetic and something that we're still talking about today when it comes to trans and the LGBTQ community. And I felt like Glenn or Glenda had a tremendous heart. And you see that heart in Burton's rendition of those scenes as well, in the depiction of Johnny Depp as
Wood. It's really cool to see those two films specifically, because it feels like Glenn or Glenda is kind of the one that defines Ed Wood himself, and Plan 9 from Outer Space defines his career. And I think it's really interesting that it's those two that he focuses in on, because I think it's the perfect kind of films to look at. And it's funny because I, like, as bad, especially for Plan 9 from Outer Space, as bad as that movie is, Ed Wood, you know, adds that level of appreciation to the craft of it. And, you know, you can kind of go back to it and kind of feel this kind of endearing quality, you know, as, you know, mind-numbingly boring as it is, there's still something that you can kind of, you know, get from it because of the passion that Ed Wood had just for that art.
Now, Sean, what was your feeling about Ed Wood's relationship with Bela Lugosi, as seen in this film, with actors Depp and Martin Landau?
Oh my God! I know we were talking about Landau, but again, I had no context. I didn't know Lugosi. I'd heard the name, but I didn't know who he was and what the relationship was. So when we were talking about, like, oh yeah, Landau, he got an Oscar for this and da da da, I was like, okay, great, great. I didn't realize. I was like, oh, the guy who played Dracula. Oh my God! And totally unexpected. Again, another. I expected this movie to focus specifically on Plan 9. I thought it was going to be kind of kooky and funny and like, look at these goofy guys making a movie. I did not expect to be so moved by that relationship. I didn't know that relationship was, I mean, it's essentially the heart of the movie. It's the emotional core of the film, and completely caught me off guard, and I absolutely amazing. I was totally blown away. I thought, I mean, Martin Landau, I think, is such a great actor, and I frankly can't think of the only thing I can think I've seen him in is the X-Files movie.
I'm sure I've seen a great performance from him. I love him in the X-Files movie.
He's great in that movie, but I can't think of anything specifically. So to see him, to really love this actor and to see him in this movie, just so incredible. And it's a part that you have to walk a very fine line, because it could easily become caricature and it could become just like, oh, this guy is ridiculous. But he somehow imbues it with this sincerity and believability, and it's so genuine. And Depp is kind of the flip side of that, not in terms of quality. He's fantastic, but he's a little more unhinged, a little more exaggerated, a little less believable. But you love his enthusiasm, and it really endears you to his character as well, to see him just kind of oblivious to the criticism and so passionate about getting this guy his chance in the spotlight, his return to the spotlight. It was really touching.
Sorry, Aaron, I'm going to keep interrupting you because we're podcast buddies ourselves.
Why change things now?
Yeah, that's right. I love how Burton has the balls, and I think it's because of the Rick Baker makeup effects, to have a scene in which old Bela Lugosi, played by Martin Landau, with Ed Wood, are watching White Zombie on the screen, and they're showing the real Bela Lugosi on the image and cutting back to fake Bela Lugosi. And you're like, that's a pretty good likeness.
Yeah.
And Landau and Lugosi really don't look anything alike outside of that makeup.
I just couldn't. I actually had to do a double take and look it up. I was like, he's playing Lugosi, right? Oh my god! But totally blown away by that performance. I thought it was so good, and their relationship was. It was the key component to, I think, what really elevates this movie.
I think the thing that I really like the most, when you were talking earlier about the disaster artist and how, you know, I think maybe that subject is a little, it's a little more, you know, involved because we're at such like a stage in the movie making industry where, if you needed to, you know, not go to film school to learn how to make a movie, you could do it. I mean, you could, you know, and you know, your access to tools to making a movie are, you know, much more, it's a lot easier. And so, for filmmakers, you know, especially in like kind of the golden age of Hollywood, they really had that passion to go out and make their art. And, but knowing that he wasn't good, you know, I think that it was kind of known back then as well. So the amount of admiration that Tim Burton takes to Ed Wood, I think, is really endearing. It's the fact that he doesn't ridicule him at all. I don't think he really like glorifies him in a way. I think he just looks at everything from an Ed Wood point of view. You know, it's a very kind of optimistic point of view, which. You know, I kind of look at some of Tim Burton's other movies, and he's a very, as kind of like emotionally, you know, gothy and emo as Tim Burton is as a character himself. He's a fairly optimistic person in the kind of movies that he produces.
And earnest. I think like the big takeaway from watching Ed Wood this time and is focused around the relationship of Wood and Lugosi and how that sort of reflects Burton's own relationship with Vincent Price, which is what apparently spawned him to take this script. And so when you see this love of Woods to Lugosi, this fanish excitement of seeing him in the coffin shop, testing out the coffins for his Dracula production that he's about to take on the road again. What you're also seeing is what it must have been like the first time Burton saw Vincent Price in person and how he got Price to be the voice and the narrator for his other love letter to the Price's career, Vincent, the animated short. I think that's what really makes Ed Wood such a personal movie for Burton and such a reflection of who he is as a creative.
Yeah. And I mean, the introductions of the characters, I read that the writers specifically wanted each introduction to be so particular to those characters. Like each one has a very specific intro that is perfectly reflective of who they are. But something it's like with Vampira, she's on television, and with the big guy who
played Johnson.
He's wrestling. Each character has a very specific introduction that defines them. And what's funny, we talked about it a little bit behind the scenes of this recording, but the writers, so it's Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, is that it?
Yeah, that's close enough.
Close enough, let's assume. But so they have a real interesting story. This was something they'd wanted to do since they'd been students at USC Film School, but the only thing they'd done up to this point in their careers was the Problem Child movies, and they did not want that to be their sole claim to fame.
Hey,
shame.
If that was my sole claim to fame, I'd be pretty damn happy. Those movies are great.
Right? Success.
But like that, so it's I love that story though. I love that. It's almost not quite evocative, but very similar in spirit to like we have to do something that's going to be special and is going to stand the test of time. Again, this movie is so. I just love how much of a celebration it is, and how you have this group of people who are so easy to mock, but Burton doesn't mock them, and the script doesn't mock them, and the performances, they may be exaggerated, but they're nothing about this movie is mocking. And you have Bill Murray playing this character who wants to become a woman and nobody like it. It's so. I mean, this is what 94.
94. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is early 90s. Just the fact that it's not surprising to me that this movie did not have the financial success. It's an odd movie. It's not as literally colorful, but like it doesn't feel as zany and colorful as Burton's other movies. It was following Batman Returns, so it's not surprising, but it's not too shocking because of some of the subject matter. But it is amazing that they so boldly moved forward with the story.
I wonder what the reaction would be like today if a film like Ed Wood came out, because 1994 nostalgia porn wasn't as prevalent as it is today. And so looking back at a B movie mogul, for lack of a better word, like Ed Wood, truly felt like a niche idea, and not as many cineasts are out there who would cherish somebody like Ed Wood when there's people like Godard and Scorsese to fawn over. Whereas like now, as we're making movies cherishing and fawning over Tommy Wiseau, I think people have a better knowledge of trash cinema. I think they have a better appreciation for trash cinema. And I think a character like Ed Wood would be celebrated a little bit stronger in today's cinematic climate than it was in the early to mid 90s.
I think the internet has something big to do with that because of the access that we have to a lot of different things. I mean, there's so much like just, meltcore like 80s horror movies that you can watch just on YouTube or something, just like, the most obscure, weird stuff that can just pop up on any sort of streaming site. And, there's no better way to kind of watch that sometimes than on just like, a crappy little screen. And, but yeah, especially for the 90s, because it seems like every decade has like their sort of nostalgia films, but it's always in like, let's say like 20-year increments, because like in the 90s, we're focusing on like 70s. In the 2000s, it was all 80s nostalgia. And now we're rounding out, going back into like 90s, you got mid 90s that just came out this year.
That was actually pretty good.
Yeah. You have so much stuff where we're looking back. Dope. That came out what, year or two ago. Yeah. So there, it always kind of, but to throw in a 50s black and white, picture, it takes a certain set of balls to put that out there. And, it didn't pay off for him, at least financially, but I think a lot of Tim Burton fans, I guess I'll ask you guys this. I mean, do you think that this is more of people who classify themselves as like Tim Burton diehard fans? Is this their favorite Tim Burton film, or is this more the cinephile, favorite Tim Burton film?
I think it's definitely the cinephile's Tim Burton film. I'd like to meet a full-on Tim Burton head who's, just as much about Big Eyes and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory as they are Beetlejuice and Batman or whatever. I feel like the conversation right now out there, as we talked about before the break, it's we're sad. The conversation is about the decline of Burton's creativity. And I'm waiting to love a Burton film today as much as I did Ed Wood. And who knows, maybe the Dumbo live action film will be that. I have my doubts. I'm so sick of live action Disney movies, but they keep on coming, man.
Yeah, it's never going to stop. Well, I agree with Brad. I think this is the cinephile's favorite, because I think when I think of Tim Burton fans, I'm thinking of... This is mostly from my experiences in high school, but we're like really obnoxious, like gothy emo girls who are like, oh my God, I love Johnny Depp, Edward Scissorhands. So I just think of, I just have this very like, oh my God, I like that style just drives me crazy. And so Ed Wood is so, it's very, again, it's not, there isn't anything necessarily attractive about it from a general audience standpoint. It's about an obscure character. It's in black and white. There isn't any, like, the quirkiness is there, but it's not like the outlandish quirkiness of his earlier films.
Well,
it's
no
not
matter.
Fairy tale. It's a fairy tale. Yeah. It does feel like a fairy tale, but it's not fantastical in the way that I think people expect from Burton at this point.
Whatever year Ed Wood came out would never make as much money as something like Batman.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
But it might have been received slightly better today than yesterday.
Absolutely.
I do believe that.
I think so. I think people would at least, like Aaron was saying, I think the internet plays a huge part. And I think the acclaim of the movie, and especially if Tim Burton made it now, it would be, a return to form and da-da-da. But it is kind of, I mean, what do you guys think? This feels like, I guess from this point on, and I know Mars Attacks followed this, and then we're moving into Burton kind of being more full of himself and more like, oh, yes, I'm a genius. This feels like the last time his style really served the story instead of vice versa. I mean, do you think it was just this movie kind of broke him in a way, the lack of success it had financially?
I think the lack of success of Ed Wood coupled with his next film, Mars Attacks, and then Sleepy Hollow, definitely drove him to a place where he's like, well, I'm going to do Planet of the Apes and I need another Batman, you know? it's interesting to me. This is also the first film that he worked with Lisa Marie, who plays Vampyra, and right. She also plays the Martian girl in Mars Attacks.
I did a rewatch of Mars Attacks as well.
Yeah, it's such a good movie.
Yeah, that was good.
Check that out.
I like that film. And, you know, she's in Sleepy Hollow, and then she goes to Planet of the Apes. And Planet of the Apes is also where Helena Bonham Carter comes on. And now Tim Burton falls out of love with Lisa Marie, falls into love with Helena Bonham Carter, ditches Lisa Marie from his movies. And, you know, the Helena Bonham Carter era, I don't want nothing to do with that.
Well, it's such a shame because I do naysay on Burton a lot, and I think for good reason, but at the same time, I love that I have this excuse to talk with you guys to see this movie and to really respect him, because I feel like I don't get to do that a lot. And there are a lot of great, great filmmakers in this day and age who have lived through some crazy, crazy decades who are just not on top of their game anymore. And I just want... Watching Ed Wood, I'm like, oh man, I wish it wasn't so easy for me to beat up on Burton these days, because I feel the spirit and love of filmmaking and the love for a good story in Ed Wood that I'm just missing from a lot of his other stuff.
I feel like if Tim Burton had a heart attack halfway through Sleepy Hollow and died, we would celebrate.
I just released the half of the movie.
Yeah, we would celebrate him as this brilliant auteur filmmaker, and you would look at this run of movies of his and you treat him like we do the Coens. It's just that he didn't have that heart attack and he just kept on going.
What a shame. Come on, Tim Burton.
About the you know, a little more of the artistic flourishes of this movie, I believe this was the first one that he did not do with Danny Elfman.
This is true.
Howard Shore, because they were fighting at this time, and I think they
I know the whole story.
And...
You want to know the what whole story?
I want to hear the story.
Go for it. Was there a girl involved?
No, not girl involved. Oh. So right. They, you know, they were making Nightmare Before Christmas together. Burton was producer, Henry Selick was the director, and Elfman did all the music, right? And he provided the voice of Jack Skellington, both as the singer and as the you know, the regular old character. And Selick watches the movie with Elfman's track. He likes his singing voice, and he goes, you know what? He's not right for the character's voice. We need to bring in Chris Sarandon, redo all of his dialogue with Sarandon's voice. And Burton agreed, fires Elfman off of that part of the film, and everything builds to a boil. He's enraged, and they split because of that decision.
Mm.
And he refuses to do the music for Ed Wood. And eventually they patch it up while Burton is filming Mars Attacks, and Elfman agrees to come back to the fold and do the score for that film and every other film after that except for Sweeney Todd.
So just a brief hiccup.
I thought maybe Burton said something bad about Oingo Boingo or something.
Burton was totally into Oingo Boingo. I can tell.
Yeah.
I think he was upset with Elfman for breaking up Oingo Boingo. Came to the forefront.
But you know, Howard Shore's score is still pretty darn good in Ed Wood.
It's great.
I like it.
Great.
Yeah.
I love me some Howard Shore, and I was very excited when I saw his name pop up. I was like, oh great, awesome. I'm a huge fan of the soundtrack. It's got this kind of tragicomic sense that the movie has. It perfectly evokes that.
And how it adopts the techniques of the 50s B movie and really does some exciting things with the theremin that I really appreciate. And I think Danny Elfman would have done similar type of tactics on this film. And I'd be curious to see what a Danny Elfman Ed Wood scored film would sound like. But I don't miss him either.
Yeah. Well, when I was listening to it, I think I completely skipped on the part of seeing that it was Howard Shore. And for some reason it has like Elfman flair to it. I don't know if he had any preconceived notes or anything, but also Elfman kind of has that sort of like childish sort of vintage sound to a lot of his scores. So maybe it's just like maybe I think with Burton, I always kind of symbolize or I always kind of like audioize an Elfman score along with Burton visuals.
Agreed.
So maybe I'm just kind of like putting it there together.
So if you listen to the Elfman score for Mars Attacks, I really feel like that's the score he would have used on Ed Wood.
Yeah.
I should check that out. But as far as this movie goes, is there anything about it that doesn't necessarily work? Did you notice anything that you were like, oh, you know what? This doesn't work as well as I remember it, or anything that holds back the movie? If I were to nitpick, I don't know if there's a whole lot I didn't like about the movie. I think it's one of those movies that feels very much like, in terms of The Big Lebowski, that was a movie I saw and I hated, and I've seen multiple times since, and I adore it. It's probably my favorite comedy. Ed Wood felt similar in terms of, I didn't hate it, but it felt like I know I'm gonna like this more because it's going to sit with me, and the quotes are so fantastic. That, I think, made it a little hard to connect to at first. But also, I think because Ed Wood's character is so kind of static throughout, he's so he's endearing and he's inspiringly optimistic. But it's almost like there isn't a whole lot of emotional
arc
depth to him. And it really comes from his relationship with Lugosi, but I think that maybe was a little hard. It was hard to connect to Edward. Like, I was expecting to maybe connect with him a little bit more emotionally. But what about you guys?
I think for me, it might just be like a length issue. I feel like, you know, it could have been edited down just a tiny bit, because I think when directors get into kind of passion projects that they are in love with, or you know, kind of their love letter to cinema, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is like Peter Jackson with King Kong, and it's a beautiful looking movie. There's lots of great parts to it, but it's so overlong. And right. I'm not saying this is a 3-hour magnum opus of going to Skull Island and bringing back the Eighth Wonder of the World, but I feel like for a what is essentially a biopic sort of thing, and a comedy at that, and in black and white, I feel like it could have been trimmed down and a little bit snappier at times. So I think that's my only real, nitpick about it.
I think when Martin Landau's Bela Lugosi passes away, some of my emotional connection to the film also disappears.
And you do
feel the length a little bit. And as much as I like all the Plan 9 from Outer Space stuff, and some of it's the most memorable moments from the film, when you look back on it, I don't think it's as good as the filming of Glenn or Glenda, or the initial relationship as it builds with Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, that was what I think part of my disconnect was the fact that I was expecting Plan 9 to take up such a prominent role mm-hmm. in the movie, and it happens so quickly at the end. And then when it does happen, it feels very much like Burton was like, okay, but we have to make sure we show this part, and we have to show we're filming this part, and these things that people will remember from Plan 9. And it felt very kind of like, we've got to make sure we fit all those little visual elements and cues in there, so people who are, you know, Plan 9 fans and know the movie can be like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
but I agree with you. I think it was tough because that the movie relies so heavily on that relationship, and you do lose that emotional angle.
Well, my only quibbles with the film, while I agree the length is, you know, you feel it a little bit, in watching Glenn or Glenda and seeing that actual Ed Wood on screen, and granted that's a performance, it's not what he was like off the set and out of celluloid, Johnny Depp doesn't necessarily feel like the guy I would have cast in this movie. I enjoy his performance and that manic energy that he brings to it, that zealous, almost overbearing enthusiasm. But I'm also now curious what another actor would do with that character. Maybe something a little more subdued. And then
what's Brad's dream cast? Ed Wood?
I wish I had done some actual thinking on answering that question for you, Aaron, before I posed it. I really don't have somebody that springs to mind.
Well, how about let's stick with Tim Burton actors. What about Michael Keaton?
Oh man, that's interesting. No, I don't like that either. You know, hey, here's who I think would be kind of interesting: Vincent D'Onofrio, who shows up in this movie as Orson Welles. Again, like we said, not his voice, but Maurice LaMarche doing the Welles voice. I think Vincent D'Onofrio would be a pretty interesting Ed Wood.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay. I love Keaton. Now that I've said it, I love Keaton so much that I almost just want to see
him. I like my answer way better.
You know what? I prefer my version. Yeah, I think I typically agree with me much more than anybody else on this show. But Aaron, what do you think?
I agree with you more than I agree with Brad anyways. So,
bastard.
I don't know. I really like Johnny Depp in the role of Ed Wood. I just like his kind of like frail kind of manicness that he's bringing to it. Cause I feel like there's a lot of energy that he provides that in this, you know, very subdued tale, I'm not sure if we would get that sort of, you know, same kind of comedic flair. Cause I think somebody as over the top is, I mean, we're talking mid 90s. So, I mean, they could have easily put Jim Carrey in the role.
No.
And I think, yeah, I agree. It would have been, you know, way too.
It would have been that,
you know,
movie. Yeah,
there.
It would have been Jim Carrey.
Yeah, it would have been a Jim Carrey movie. And this doesn't feel like a Johnny Depp movie. This feels like an Ed Wood movie. And it's the kind of persona that whether he was, you know, as Johnny portrays him, that's how I see him. I really like the way that he's brought to the screen.
Brad, I have to ask you this. Do you think, because I do see what you're saying. I think when the movie started, I was a little more like, I don't know how I feel about this. But he kind of won me over with his performance. And yeah, because I couldn't tell if he was putting me on. But then you realize, oh, no, it's coming from a place of sincerity. But do you think maybe the frustration of the performance, or maybe the reason you didn't connect with it as strongly, is just because of Johnny Depp quirk in the 21st century he and Tim Burton have such similar trajectories in terms of, you loved them, they were great, they kind of peaked in the same time period, or Johnny Depp a little later. I think the first Pirates movie was fantastic.
I like all three.
Oh, okay, well there you go. So
The first three. Not that's a all whole of other. Them. I don't like the
that's
last.
That's a whole
two.
Other conversation. But yeah. Do you think maybe part of the disconnect this time was just Depp overload in this day and age, and just being annoyed with his shtick?
That's possible. But I gotta say, I think the reason why I don't feel it as much as I once did is because I watched Glenn or Glenda. I think if I had not seen Ed Wood's actual performance in that film, I would feel the same way.
Gotcha. Well,
I love Johnny Depp in this movie. Don't get me wrong. I think he's really fantastic. And
Sounds like a hater.
No. If you twisted my arm and you asked me what my favorite Johnny Depp performance is, I might actually say Ed Wood. I just now wonder if what this movie would be like with a different actor, and an actor who sort of resembled the lower energy of Ed Wood in Glenn or Glenda.
Let me add two more, you know, kind of mid 90s actors, and let me get, you know, some feedback.
Mark Dacascos. I'm
the casting agent. Robert Downey Jr. He's, you know.
Yeah.
He just done Chaplin. Okay. Hadn't he done Chaplin around that time?
Yeah.
I feel like maybe he would have been like, no, not another black and white.
That's interesting. Director.
Okay. What about Tim Robbins?
That's interesting too. That's not bad. Huh. That's not bad.
Yeah, I could see that too.
Especially the Tim Robbins from Howard the Duck.
I think it would have to be that version.
Yeah.
Only that version. Well, on the flip side of things, because, you know, we've been kind of breaking the movie down and criticizing some bits, the complete opposite end. And Aaron, we'll start with you. What are your favorite scenes and moments?
Interrupt him.
Get away from the negative Nancy Brad over here hating on Johnny Depp. No.
Uh-huh.
But Aaron, what do you think in terms of favorite moments, favorite quotes, things that you use to sell this movie to other people? What are the moments that really stand out for you?
Man, I mean, I'm such a fan of practical effects, and anytime really good makeup is put in, you know, as subdued and as minimalist as it is, Rick Baker just does an amazing job of transforming Martin Landau.
Oh my God,
so that's such a huge thing. But just that relationship between Johnny Depp and Martin Landau, I really like the kind of the kind of crazed, you know, actions. I don't know. I actually think, you know, I'm thinking about it more, the whole supporting cast, like real group of, like, I mean, they're real just like a big bunch of misfits. They don't belong in this movie. They don't belong anywhere. They're already the outcasts, and they completely sell for me. I would love to see like a sort of a really great poster, kind of like, you know, like a Wes Anderson poster of, like, you know, all these characters put into one, you know, just kind of single file line, like, you know, Tor Johnson, just like, you know, this big bulking guy, and Bill Murray's bunny. I would just love to see, they have all so many great visual flares, and, you know, they all look very Tim Burton-esque in their kind of, you know, exaggeration. And so I think the actors just feeding off each other's energy is the biggest part for me.
I feel like we need to get a Mondo poster, if there isn't one already. Yeah. Ed Wood Mondo poster would be great. But Brad, what about you?
I think it all comes down to how Burton sees Ed Wood as this figure to aspire towards. And, you know, you go to the set of his apartment, and here's this guy who has two posters on the wall. One is Citizen Kane, and one is Dracula. And I get that dude. I am that dude. And I think Tim Burton is too. And this movie is just such a love letter to the guy who helped turn Burton into the artist that he is today, whether that guy is Ed Wood or that guy is Vincent Price.
Right. I love, and it, like you said, this feels like such a celebration, and it's so uncynical, and it's funny and heartfelt. I think for me, what really stands out is that core relationship between them, and as we've already discussed. But I also, the movie is so quotable. That's one of those things where I feel like when I go back and rewatch it, it's going to be even more enjoyable, just now understanding and being on the wavelength of the movie. But the one of the lines that stands up to me that I love so much is when they're all getting baptized so that they can get funding for the movie. And he asks Bill Murray's character, do you reject Satan and all his evils? And Bill Murray just goes, sure. it's so good. But there's so many quick one-liners that totally caught me off guard. The, we don't have a permit. run, and all that stuff. I just think that this movie is so quotable and lovable, and I love that it's the movie. It ends like they do the premiere, and it's Plan 9 from Outer Space, the worst movie ever made, quote unquote. And they run out of the theater, and it's beautiful, and he wants to get married, and it's a happy ending. And then the postscript is so, it's just like Johnny Depp's smiling face, and Ed Wood dissolved into alcoholism and it was dubbed the worst director. I kind of had a chuckle where I was like, oh, poor guy. I love that this movie like gives you that kind of affection for the character.
Well, the idea that Plan 9 from Outer Space is this triumphant moment, you know, it's going to go on and be the best bad movie of all time. Woohoo.
Aaron, what were you saying?
Just that I think that almost emphasizes Burton really pushing this as a lens through Ed Wood's eyes. Like, he's the one that this is the way he saw life. And he always had such an optimistic, you know, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it as a filmmaker. I don't even think he wanted to necessarily make it. I think he saw Orson Welles as the filmmaker. So he was just like, I just want to make it as a filmmaker. This is my art. Whether he knew he was good or not, I think he just had this real, positive outlook on life. And I think that's something worth admiring. You know, like you said, the final shot, them, you know, going off to get married, and it's pouring down rain and their car's getting flooded. And it's like, you know, just enjoying the misery.
Yeah. And it doesn't put a damper on the experience. It's a really, the more I think about Ed Wood, I think I knew I liked it, but the more I thought about it, the more and more it grows. My affection grows for it. But I guess, is there anything else that needs to be said about Ed Wood before we give our final ratings? We're good. We got it. So I'd say final ratings. Let's say how many pink angoras on a scale from 1 to 5 would you give Ed Wood, Brad?
4 pink angora sweaters for sure.
Perfect. And Aaron, how about you?
We're in the Holding Hands Club. 4 out of 5 pink angora sweaters.
My podcast buddy.
I'm with you guys. I give it a solid 4, and it's one I expect to revisit. And it makes me want to delve into Edward Scissorhands and some other movies, and even revisit the Batman movies that I despise so much. But I'm gaining an affection for Tim Burton that I'm happy to get.
This is kind of off topic, but how are you on the non-Tim Burton early Batman films, Forever and Robin? Those are the two good ones.
Those are the, I mean, what are we, what, Nolan trilogy? Are you kidding me? Batman and Robin. This is a topic for, it's going to open a can of worms. I'll say it, and then let's wrap things up, because this will go on and on. God. But I Batman Forever is my favorite of the first 4 Batman movies. And it's only because it's the only one of those 4 movies that tries to explore Batman as a character.
Does
as opposed to
interesting. Do you want to we could go into a fight, because I just watched those, I think this last summer with the kids. We watched all 4 of them, and I was in the camp of, like, you know, oh, the first 2 Burtons, you know, first one's good, Returns is great. And then I was usually in the camp of, like, you know, 3 is meh and 4 is abysmal. I think Batman and Robin is better than Batman Forever.
You Brad, guys are
dying. This is another. We're gonna do a between. You know what? Let's say it right now. Let's do a between takes episode. That's just let's go through the entire the original Batman franchise. You know, not.
I'm all for it.
Adam
I think
West.
I can. I think I can. I think I can put out a reasonable explanation. So let's do it.
Let's put that on the docket.
I'm
but,
for it.
Gentlemen, thank you again. This was such a pleasure to talk with both of you. But you guys have an amazing podcast. You guys are doing awesome things. I want to hear all about them. Our audience needs to hear about them. So tell me about Rest in Pictures Podcast.
Brad, take it away.
No, I'm going to let you talk about it.
Oh, it's, all right, all right.
You are the originator. I'm just the guy who...
That is true.
Wormed my way
takes
on.
All the glory.
Yeah. And then interrupts all
much.
Over everyone.
Yeah. With all your bad opinions.
No.
Aaron! Yeah. No. So our podcast, we say the beginning. We celebrate the Oh my God! I just
you
lost
suck
our little butter.
You should have let Brad do it.
We celebrate cinematic life through death. We look at an individual who has either recently passed away, or we go and we're trademarking this. And so every time somebody says that they owe us money, we go through a death anniversary. So like, you know, if it's a 2 year, 5 year, 10 year death anniversary, the anniversary of when they passed, we like to not, you know, necessarily, you know, hang our heads at, oh no, they're gone and we have nothing else to get from them. We want to look at the entire, you know, wealth of all the art that they gave us when they were here. And so like our last podcast, our last two podcasts, we've kind of gone a little different. The last one we did was Stan Lee, which, you know, not a pure cinematic icon, but a groundbreaking innovator of cinema nonetheless, with the creations that he created. And the time before that, we were looking at the demise of Filmstruck, which was such a wonderful access of vintage cinema that we had to cherish that. And the next episode, I guess we can make an exclusive here, right, Brad?
Yeah.
Yeah. exclusive. Our next episode, whenever we get around to recording it, we're going to be looking at Penny Marshall.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's going to be great. Yeah. But I mean, it's a fantastic concept. It's a fantastic
Thank
show.
You.
I could listen to you guys talk all day. Part of the pain of doing this Ed Wood episode is that I have to barge in every so often and remind people that I'm here as well. And Brad, so you do Brad, you do Rest in Pictures Pod, and you also have the Itmod cast as well.
Yeah, and I have a new one on top of that. My wife and I
That's
just
right.
started a comic book podcast called the Comic Book Couples Counseling Podcast, where we explore relationships of comic book couples like Scott Summers and Jean Grey of the X-Men, or Marco and Alana from Saga. So we're having fun there.
Basically, the market's cornered.
Yes.
This is between the three of us, we've got the market cornered for podcasts.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's great. But also, I'll go ahead and give a shout out to the Nerd Party as well, and encourage everybody to check it out at thenerdparty.com. There's tons of great stuff to listen to. We've got Filibuster. We've got Time and Space with Doctor Who. Not the actual Doctor, but it's about Doctor Who. And there's Harry Potter stuff, Star Trek, Star Wars, everything you could possibly want. So definitely give that a check out as well. And if you like what you're hearing, feel free to give us a 5-star rating. Do it.
Yeah.
Only my podcast, though. Just
no.
mine. Give it to everybody. And I do recommend, I mean, these guys are doing great work and it's fantastic. So do check that out. And again, thank you. Thank you so much. I am going to hold you to that between takes episode of the Batman series, because Ed Wood has kind of re-sparked my interest in trying to watch those Batman, those first two without my negative filter on, and trying to respect Burton a little more.
I'm for it. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having us on.